Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest, always a pleasure to talk to him, is award-winning nonfiction author Eric J. Dolan. And we're talking about his new book, very apropos, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. Eric, welcome back to the show. It's really a pleasure to talk to you.
Great, thanks for having me.
Especially about this book. Now, you're like, you seem to be specializing in maritime and nautical stuff, and I love that.
Yeah, no, I've always loved the ocean. When I was a kid, I actually wanted to be Jacques Cousteau when I grew up. I grew up on the edge of Long Island Sound, and I used to collect seashells and go in tide pools, and everything I read, not everything I read, but a lot of stuff that I read was about the ocean. I evolved over time, and I didn't want to be a marine biologist anymore, but when I started writing, one of the topics that intrigued me the most were tales about the ocean. And right now I live in Marblehead, Massachusetts.
Oh, whoa.
Which is right.
It's a hard life for a writer.
Yeah.
I know Marblehead well. Yeah. Now, this is an incredible book, and I just want to mention, we're only going to scratch the surface of this. This has got some horrific but still breathtaking tales of hurricanes hitting the United States. One of my earliest memories as a child in the early 50s was when I lived in Watertown outside of Boston. We got nailed by a hurricane. I can't remember if it was Carol or Diana or some other hurricane. Yeah. And I can remember my parents buying old hurricane lanterns because they knew that they and that was sort of weird, which we kept in the cellar from then on. This is an amazing book. And as you write, hurricanes have always been an inevitable part of the American experience. But are they also part of the European experience or the African experience, or only we on the west side of the Atlantic experience hurricanes?
No, well, hurricanes go by different names in different parts of the world. In the Atlantic and the eastern Pacific, including Hawaii, we call them hurricanes. But if you were over in the Indian Sea, they would call them cyclones. If you were in Australia, they call them Willy Willy, actually, and cyclones.
That's Australia
so,
for you.
So there are different terms in different parts of the world, but they all refer to the same thing, which is basically meteorologists would call it a cyclone, which is a swirling, spiraling storm that has winds of at least 74 miles per hour. But the hurricanes that I talk about are the ones that hit what eventually became the United States, and the ones that command most of our attention here in this country.
It's amazing to read the statistics about hurricanes in the United States, as you write in your book. They've accounted for 50% of all the cost of natural disasters in the United States.
Yeah.
And from the late 1800s, they've killed 30,000 people.
Right. It's amazing to me that they haven't killed more, actually. But fortunately, people are able to run from the water or sometimes hide from the wind. And as we've come into modern times, people are getting better and better at listening to advance warnings and evacuating when necessary.
Although I still know people that take their sailboards down to the Cape Cod beaches when a hurricane hits.
Yeah, there are always going to be people like that, and there are always going to be people that throw what are commonly called hurricane parties.
Oh.
You know, laughing in the face of terror.
What's amazing to me is how long we have historical accounts of hurricanes in the United States. You have one in the 1500s in Florida. Did they know that they were going through something different that they'd never experienced before?
Yeah. Well, basically, the first European to really encounter a hurricane was Christopher Columbus in 1502 on his fourth voyage. So by the time that the Spanish and French in the 1550s and 1560s were trying to colonize parts of Florida and also battling each other and hurricanes, they knew about hurricanes in Europe. And sort of to go back to your earlier question, I want to make clear that in Europe, England, France, and the continent, they experience rather savage storms, and they often get the remnants of our hurricanes because they sweep up the Atlantic and then they go across towards the continent. But it's very rare and almost it never happens that Europe gets hit with what we would call officially a hurricane at the time. Sometimes there are winds that approach hurricane strength or gusts, but that's not really where most of the hurricane activity takes place.
Well, and also I know that within Asia, especially India, China, and Japan, they get nailed by typhoons all the time.
Yeah, typhoons are exactly another word for hurricane. And oftentimes when you hear about those, unfortunately, the death tolls can be horrific, into the hundreds of thousands, in part because their infrastructure, because a lot of those countries are much poorer, is not even as strong as our infrastructure along the coast. But our houses and buildings get clobbered too.
Now, there was a 1609 Jamestown, Virginia hurricane, and then there was the great, my favorite early one is the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635, which totaled Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that was, I mean, there weren't many people on the continent at that point, tens of thousands, and they'd come over here trying to find a new way of life, and all of a sudden this hurricane just clobbers the region, killing Indians and colonists alike, destroying numerous houses, sinking ships, causing ships to crash, and it was such a seminal event. It had such a major impact on the region that a lot of the most famous scribes of the time, like William Bradford, wrote about that hurricane. So we have a lot of information, more than you might expect about old hurricanes, even going back to the 1500s, but certainly in the 1700s and 1800s, hurricanes of great violence and force and ones that hit in populated areas or caused a particularly dramatic event to take place were the ones that people wrote about and wrote about extensively. And that benefited me as a writer.
Right.
So it is amazing when you comb history to see how many different topics people were writing about. And we're lucky for that because we can recreate what happened.
Now, the interesting thing, and I'm so glad you sort of teased this out of this story, and it goes throughout the middle of the book, getting hold of being able to forecast a hurricane has everything to do with the whole history of weather forecasting and looking at the weather as something that you may be able to predict. And you bring that back to Benjamin Franklin and Winthrop, beginning a process of scientific inquiry about hurricanes.
Yeah, before the 1740s, people really just viewed hurricanes as something of God's design. You never knew what was going to happen. They often thought that hurricanes, since they weren't connected by communication lines very well, people often thought that hurricanes arose and died in basically the same place. But then in 1743, the so-called eclipse hurricane happened. There was going to be an eclipse of the moon, and Benjamin Franklin, who was in Philadelphia, wanted to go out and watch it. But as he left his house and looked towards the sky, the clouds came in, and then a terrific hurricane, a major storm, bore down on him. And he assumed, because the winds were coming from the northeast, they were coming from the direction of Boston, essentially, he thought that the storm must have been there first in Boston and then come down. They sort of figured that out later. But really what he was on the left side of the hurricane.
Right,
he heard later
right.
that his brother in Boston had been able to go out and see the eclipse. So suddenly he realized, he looked at all these newspaper accounts, he said, wow, the storm wasn't coming from the north to the south. It was actually traveling from Philadelphia to Boston. He didn't understand that he was in the midst of a spiraling storm and that he's on one side of it, but he did sort of prove that hurricanes can move in a direction that is contrary to the direction in which the winds are blowing at the time. And then Jonathan Winthrop, the grandson of the early governor of the Plymouth Colony, of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, he used the first barometer in the colonies to measure the pressure of that hurricane, which was not a super strong hurricane. But that was the start of our understanding, but it took a long time for the science of meteorology to mature, and there are fascinating debates. One of the parts of the book that I found most interesting was in the 1800s when amateur and professional meteorologists were debating about the nature of a hurricane and how the winds operate.
This was my favorite section, too. You had people like William C. Redfield.
Yeah,
tell that story because that's really interesting.
Well, William Redfield he owned a saddling store. He was sort of an orphan. His mother moved out to the Midwest, left him in Connecticut to apprentice in a saddling shop, and he was always very interested in science and a lot of issues. And luckily, there was a doctor in the town who had a good library. Let William read in that library. William was very smart, very inquisitive. He grew up to have a very successful shop, and later on he had a successful steamship business. But in 1821, there was a hurricane that ripped through New England, And right after that hurricane went by, his wife had died right around that time. So he had to travel from Cromwell, Connecticut, north and west, about 70 miles to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, to tell his in-laws that their beloved daughter and his wife had died. And he noticed something really strange on the trip. All of the trees near his house were knocked down by the winds, and they were facing in a northwest direction. They had toppled with their crowns facing towards the northwest. But then when he got to his in-law's house, which was basically 70 miles north and to west, all of the trees were toppled, but they were facing in the exact opposite direction towards the southeast. And he thought about it for a while, and what he figured out, and he later took accounts of people that live in different areas, he figured out this is a big, this hurricane, this is a big rotating storm. On one side, the winds are going in one direction. On another side, they're going the opposite direction, and it's swirling around. So he was on the right side of the hurricane, and his in-laws were on the left side of the hurricane. And then he built on that understanding by studying numerous hurricanes for many, many years. He kept his image of the hurricane as this rotating storm around a central radius with winds getting stronger and stronger as you get towards the eye of the storm in the center. He kept that to himself, but then in 1831, late 1820s, he was on a steamship, and he met a Yale professor, and they started talking about meteorology. And this professor was saying to himself, this guy is really knowledgeable about meteorology. And so Redfield decided to share his theory of how hurricanes operated. Professor Olmsted from Yale said, this is fantastic. This is amazing. This is a great insight. You have to publish this. Redfield, who wasn't a scientist, thought that he would be laughed at by other meteorologists if he published his work. But Olmsted finally convinced him that you need to publish it. But Redfield got Olmsted to promise that he would help with the publication process and review the paper. And with Olmsted's help, that paper got published, and that was one of the seminal papers, a series of papers, on how hurricanes operated, his understanding of how they operated. Now, it's evolved since then, because he wasn't 100% correct. One of the things that he thought is that the winds went in a complete circle. As we learn later, when you take into account the Coriolis effect, the winds in a hurricane don't go in a perfect circle around a central point. They basically spiral or swirl in towards the center in a counterclockwise direction in the northern hemisphere and a clockwise direction in the southern hemisphere. But Redfield's contribution was seminal, as were some other meteorologists of the time.
What I love is also reading about the history of weather forecasting in the United States. When they started using the telegraph, it was Joseph Henry of the Smithsonian wanted to marry science and forecasting, and it was Ulysses S. Grant that signed the bill that gave the United States Army Signal Corps the responsibility of gathering telegraphic weather reports and issuing weather forecasts and weather maps.
Yeah.
I love that.
No, it's a great story. Just imagine, put yourself back in that time.
I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine when people didn't even understand that there was rotational winds and what that was like. But now before there's even forecasting.
Yeah, but not just for hurricanes. I mean, hurricanes, it was kind of tough still, even with telegraphs, to spread information about the approaching hurricane because it was often coming off the ocean and telegraphs didn't reach the ocean. However, they could send information up and down the coast, and it was a help, but really it helped with basic weather forecasting. Just think about how incredibly powerful it would be to a farmer in a certain area or planners or just an individual person to know that tomorrow and the next day we might have this kind of weather. It really was a fundamental transformation of our understanding of the relation between weather and our daily activities. And then it morphed into something that helped with hurricanes. But as you know, having read the book, it got better and better, our ability to track and find hurricanes as we went from telegraph to radio to, you know, hurricane hunter planes, and then finally satellites, with satellites, hurricanes can't hide. We know they're coming, but they're still some element of surprise. No track of a hurricane, no forecast of a hurricane is unerring and 100% foolproof. There are often jigs and jags. And
well, they're like animals. They seem to go where they want to go. People can make the best of predictions, but it's always a cone. And the
cone of uncertainty. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, returning, is award-winning nonfiction author Eric J. Dolan. And we're talking about his new book, God Is It Good, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricane. Now, I don't want to run out of time, so I'm going to ask you this now.
Yep.
The story of naming hurricanes is hilarious.
Yeah, that was a big surprise to me as well. Basically, hurricanes used to be named after the year or the region that occurred, like you mentioned, the Great Hurricane, Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635. But then in the 1940s...
wait a minute. Don't go there. I'm going to go back to Clement Lindley Ragg.
Clement Ragg, yeah, an Australian forecaster at the turn of the last century, a century before, in the 1900s. And he was an irascible, very well-educated, fascinating individual. And he started naming cyclones off Australia after, as he would call them, maidens, Tahitian maidens.
Oh, my God.
Women. And he got into some trouble for that, not so much naming it after maidens, but after the government cut off funding for his forecast, he started naming hurricanes after politicians that he wanted to get back at. But that was where the first person that we know of that named hurricanes after women.
Well, he gave them these like personalities, too.
Yeah, they had, you know, vicious or,
right,
or dusky maidens or, you know, well, yes, he gave them personalities, and he was quite a personality. I'd like to know more about him. But then in the 1940s, there was a book that came out in 1941 called Storm by George Stuart Rippey, which was a huge bestseller. It wasn't about a hurricane. It was about a massive storm that came across the Pacific. And in that book, he had read about Raggy. So in that book, he uses the device where he has the meteorologists who are working on tracking this storm name it after a woman. And this meteorologist names the storm Mariah. And so that book was sent out to GIs all over the world. It was very famous. And in the 1940s, in the Pacific Theater, the military started naming some hurricanes after women, but here in the Atlantic, basically the military started naming hurricanes in the late 40s and early 50s with the alphanumeric, you know, Alpha,
right,
Baker, Charlie. So that was fine for a while, but there were a couple of different naming systems. But then in the mid-1950s, they decided, taking a page from Clement Raggy and from George Stuart Rippey, to name hurricanes after women. There was some protest. A lot of women in particular didn't like the idea of women being associated with such a horrific meteorological event. One woman, sort of her tongue in cheek a little bit, said that she would much rather have an unnamed hurricane hit her house than one named after her husband's former girlfriend. And so there was a little bit of a tea and a tempest at that point. But the Weather Bureau, which is the precursor of the National Weather Service, stuck with it. In 1956, naming hurricanes after women became permanent for a while, because in the late 1960s, early 1970s, the National Organization of Women and one woman in particular, Roxy Bolton from Florida, sort of stepped up and said, we should stop naming hurricanes after women and calling them all these horrible names, nasty, vicious, you know, unladylike. And they started a campaign to get the Weather Bureau, the National Weather Service at this time, to change their mind. Roxy Bolton wasn't successful, but finally, and one of her alternatives is, why don't we call them, instead of hurricanes, let's call them himicanes, or let's name them after senators, since senators like having things named after them. But Roxy Bolton was still working on the issue when Jimmy Carter became president.
Wow.
She appointed Juanita Kreps, the first woman secretary of the Department of Commerce. She was a self-described feminist. She got the idea that this would be a good idea, and she got on board. And finally, in 1979, instead of naming hurricanes after women only, we started to name them in an alternating fashion after women and men. And that's the system that we have in place today. But it was fascinating. That was one of the most fun parts of the book to write, because I had no idea that there was this fascinating history behind the simple, the seemingly simple act of naming a hurricane.
I think you have a photograph of Roxy Bolton in the book too, don't you?
Yes, yeah, the photograph.
What a great, now there's a hero that's basically like, come off it. But the amazing thing is how long that lasted. Like, and not only that, sort of describing the hurricanes with these sort of anti-women terms too. It was just amazing.
We're
going to run out of time, so I want to make sure we keep talking.
Okay.
We got to talk about the Saffir-Simpson scale.
Okay.
How did that originate, and who were they?
Well, Saffir was doing work in the Indian region. He created this wind chart to try to evaluate how storms would affect urban areas and urban structures. And it had five categories that went from in the 70 mile an hour to up to about 150 miles per hour. And then he knew Robert Simpson, who worked for the National Weather Service on hurricane issues in particular, and he told him about his wind scale. And Simpson, who as a boy had survived the major hurricane that hit Corpus Christi, where he grew up, and had always been fascinated by hurricanes and was a seminal figure in hurricane research within this country, looked at Saffir's wind scale and said, this is just what I've been looking for. Before this, it was always hard to decide which adjectives to use to describe a hurricane to give people a sense of what was heading their way. So all of a sudden, this scale, which we know as the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale today, goes from Category 1 to 5. Category 1 are 74 to 95 miles per hour winds, sustained winds. Then Category 2, 96 to 110 miles per hour, so on and so on. And finally, you get to Category 5, which are hurricanes with 157 mile per hour sustained winds or higher. And categories 3, 4, and 5 are called, quote unquote, major hurricanes. Although hurricanes at Category 1 and Category 2 status can cause massive destruction,
as we
well know. But this Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale has become part of our culture. In fact, you know, when they talk about things happening on a dramatic scale, like a Category 5 storm blew into Wall Street and, you know, shook all the stocks. So it's become part of our cultural fabric, and it really is a very easy way for meteorologists to relay to the public what is happening, how powerful this hurricane is. And the public, especially those who are often in the track of a hurricane, know this scale very well, and they sometimes decide to act based on where on the scale the hurricane that's heading for them falls.
We've just a few minutes left. We haven't even talked about any specific hurricanes. People are going to have to read the book for that, because there's some incredible stories. I think the 1900 Galveston hurricane is the one that really gripped me.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the Hurricane Hunters, because that, as a kid, that always, you know, captured my imagination. When was the first attempt? I can't believe somebody actually had to come up with this, and somebody had to fly that first plane into a hurricane.
Well, it was a guy named Joseph Duckworth. He was a former commercial pilot, and then he got into the military in the late 1930s. And by 1943, during World War II, he was the lead flight instructor in Bryan, Texas, at a field, military field in Bryan, Texas. And a hurricane was coming in on the Gulf of Mexico into Galveston, and they flew these planes called AT-6s. And there was talk of moving them further inland to keep them out of the path of the hurricane. There were a bunch of British flying aces over there trying to learn some American techniques, and they didn't know anything about a hurricane, and they sort of laughed at the Americans and said, boy, your planes are pretty flimsy. When a storm rolls in England, we just leave them on the tarmac. So Duckworth sort of said, okay, I'm going to show you. He had long wanted to teach people how to do instrument flying, which is different than contact flying. Contact flying, you're looking at things on the ground to tell you where to go. Instrument flying is when you're in pea soup, you know, clouds and can't see anything, but you still need to know where the ground is and where you're heading. So he was training people on instrument flying, and he said, this will be the ultimate test. I'm going to take one of those planes into this approaching hurricane. And he, in fact, did it.
I can't believe it. That's amazing to me.
And he came home unscathed. People got really excited. Word got out that this had happened. And then the military got on board because they really wanted to keep hurricanes from affecting their military operations. In the Pacific Theater, William Bull Halsey and so-called Halsey's Typhoons had, on two occasions, because of bad forecasting of a coming typhoon, had destroyed a lot of his fleet. So the military was on board, the Weather Bureau was on board, and starting in the mid-1940s, they started having these Hurricane Hunter flights into hurricanes. And the thing that's most amazing about it, there have only been 6 Hurricane Hunter flights that have crashed and resulted in people dying. A Hurricane Hunter pilot once said that it's more dangerous for him to drive to the airfield and climb up the ladder into the plane than it is to fly into a raging hurricane. And that's because they're very talented flyers. These are very good planes, and they know how to enter and exit the hurricane. And what's great about it, these Hurricane Hunter planes are decked out with all sorts of scientific equipment, and they're the ones that give us valuable information, give meteorologists the valuable key information they need to make predictions about what this hurricane is likely to do.
Do we still depend upon them as much with, you know, that now that we're using satellites and we have all sorts of...
Yes.
So it's still an important thing. Do people train for that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's both the Air Force and the National Weather Service has Hurricane Hunter planes and pilots, the Air Force Reserve. But, yeah, you have to train to become a Hurricane Hunter pilot, and on board are the scientists that go along on the flight. So it is critical today, as it has been since the 1940s, and satellites, of course, make the job even easier because there's another eye on the hurricanes that never loses track of them. But as soon as a hurricane gets within flying distance, round-trip flying distance, they will often send a Hurricane Hunter flight into the hurricane to get the direct data.
We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is award-winning nonfiction author Eric J. Dolan. We're talking about his new book, A Furious Sky, the 500-year history of America's hurricanes. Eric, a pleasure as always.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks, Mark.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.